From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. On today's show, Blake Miltier, outgoing museum director at the Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center, and his soon-to-be successor, Joy Armstrong, discuss what's next for the FAC.
I would like to see us continue with that outstanding balance of historically, regionally relevant artists, of internationally significant artists, of artists who are living and working right here in Colorado Springs.
Author Jonathan Mark Antoni talks about his new book and the mentorship program that he created for up-and-coming writers.
We consider ourselves the anti-MFA program. That's what we call ourselves.
Author Jeffrey Hobbs speaks with fellow writer Helen Thorpe about his best-selling book, The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace.
Rob was my randomly paired freshman year roommate at Yale. 9 years after we graduated, I got a Facebook message. I learned that he had died violently in a basement in a drug-related homicide.
And Big Something intern Maddie Howard brings us the story of a new publication devoted to amplifying the voices of the homeless in Colorado Springs.
We go down to soup kitchens, down to Urban Peak, the youth homeless center in town, and record interviews, run writing and storytelling workshops.
All that today on The Big Something. This past November, the Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center announced that longtime chief curator and museum director Blake Miltier would be stepping down. Rather than conduct a national search, however, the FAC took the unusual step of promoting one of its own from within. Next summer, when Miltier leaves his post, curator Joy Armstrong, an artist and longtime Colorado Springs resident, will take over the creative direction of the Fine Arts Center Museum. KRCC's Noel Black sat down and spoke with both Miltier and Armstrong about the past successes and the challenges going forward.
So to start with the obvious, Blake, you announced that you will be leaving the Fine Arts Center, and then the Fine Arts Center announced that, Joy, you will be taking Blake's position when he leaves, and it's kind of like a slow transition that's happening. Why don't you both talk about what's going on? Start with you, Blake.
Well, my move is a family move to Scotland, where my wife Sarah is from, and so after about 8.5 years here in the Springs, we're going to be heading out. So have announced that to the Fine Arts Center, and so we began to think about a transition plan, and got a group together from our community and started to really think about what we were looking for in that transition. And long story short, Joy rose to the surface of that conversation, and we looked at where the Fine Arts Center has been, who we are in terms of our identity, and where we're going. And Joy was the candidate best suited to take us there.
Joy, why don't you talk about that identity and where the Fine Arts Center is going a little bit, if you would. And also introduce yourself and your background as well, and how long you've been at the Fine Arts Center.
My background is in studio art originally. Really prior to studio art, though, performing arts is my basic background growing up, and playing the piano and playing the viola and in the youth orchestra and musical theater and plays. And so I really grew up in more of a performance type of arena, not getting into visual arts so much until I was in college. But my bachelor's degree is in studio art and photography and film production primarily. And then after many years after college, went back to graduate school to study art history, where I found myself immersed in contemporary art and museum studies and finding really my true love in that arena. So I've been with the Fine Arts Center now for coming up on 6 years in various capacities. I moved back to Colorado Springs, as I'm from here. So I came back to Colorado Springs in the hopes of pursuing my career in museum studies and curatorial work, and found myself at the FAC, which was wonderful and fortuitous, and I'm thrilled to be here in my hometown. I think that there are a lot of advantages in this type of transition, and that Blake will be here for quite a few months, and that I've been at the FAC already for quite a few years, working directly with Blake on lots of different types of projects. and in that I already have a sense of the ins and outs of the FAC and the uniqueness of the institution itself, and a tremendous love for this community of Colorado Springs. And, you know, to say honestly, I don't know that you could bring somebody in that would come in with a passion for the community that somebody who's already been immersed already has.
Blake, I want to ask you to look back on your time at the FAC. You've done many things. There have been many incredibly memorable exhibitions. For me personally, I think the Floyd Tunson exhibition obviously leaps to the top of my mind just because it was such a triumph of both showing a local artist who's been in the community forever, who I don't know if he was under-recognized within the arts community, but just bringing him to the public and just recognizing what an incredible, you know, master painter and artist we had living amongst us all that time. You were instrumental in reintroducing him to the community. You've also had to juggle reviving, in some ways, the local art history in the Pikes Peak region, which is something that, unlike a community like Taos, got forgotten for many years and wasn't always the sexiest thing, let's say, to do. But also, you know, juggling, bringing in really exciting contemporary art. James Turrell is another one that pops to mind. And then also incorporating local artists on a level that's really unprecedented, again, in my memory. You know, everyone from Carol Das to Heather Elklaus to Scott Johnson and many, many others. So talk about what were your challenges and what are you most proud of?
What we like to say at the Fine Arts Center, and we absolutely believe this, is that we have a responsibility as an institution to bring the world to Colorado Springs. I think we're uniquely positioned here to do that. We also have a responsibility to get this region out to the world. And the way that hopefully has manifested in our exhibition program over the past 8 years is this beautiful balance of exhibitions of work by nationally and internationally renowned artists, as well as regional artists who, in some cases, like Floyd Tunson, we're very familiar with around here, but maybe not with the depth of his work that we were able to bring into the exhibition, as well as lesser known and sometimes up and coming artists. And what we love about that is that it really, one, helps to contextualize the art that's happening right here and right now, right? I like to think that artists making work of real consequence, work that's going to stick with us, work that's sometimes risky, work that sometimes sings to us, sometimes kind of kicks us in the teeth, is risky. And we have to, as an institution, at our best, sort of follow what the artists are doing and get things out to our communities that give you everything from the just drop-dead gorgeous to things that are quite challenging, really. And I think what we find is that artists making that kind of work are some of the most engaged, aware, and socially integrated people I know. I mean, we have this impression of the artist in their studio, this little vacuum creating these pieces of genius. But really, in fact, what it is this process of engaging with the world. And when we find the right artists to give the right opportunity, the right right space for an exhibition, and can do that side by side and simultaneously with artists who are established nationally, internationally, have some renown, have some historical importance, then I think we get a really beautiful picture of what's happening in the visual art world. And what that picture is one of engagement, right? That can, as art often is at its best, draw our attention to what's going on around us in new ways, right? Because the artists are asking questions more often than not.
And I just want to interrupt you. And I mean, thinking about the Floyd Tunson show, which took place before the Black Lives Matter movement started, again, it seems so it seems so prescient. And in many ways, I wish I could just, I could walk back through the exhibition now. And I wish I could also, you know, again, invite the world to come and see that exhibition. It does seem so eerily prescient.
We love to hear that.
We do. And, you know, the thing about Floyd's show specifically, although in retrospect, it seems prescient now, you know, Floyd was very clearly responding to prior events as well in his work. So, you know,
Trayvon through... Martin was just the month before that show opened, I think.
Right. So we see through the art really some of the continuing, ongoing issues that we're dealing with as a society that Floyd was responding to, but then clearly have not just magically gone away in the years since.
You're taking the mantle of this institution, which at the time that it opened its doors in 1936 was considered one of the greatest institutions west of the Mississippi and was at that time, has this incredible legacy. Legacies can be burdens at times, but there's also this added sea change that's happened. The amount of information that's coming at us all the time has changed the role of major arts institutions because traditionally they don't respond to the culture on a dime. And I wonder, what will your vision be going forward in terms of dealing with that historical legacy of the Fine Arts Center and also trying to be as nimble and responsive to the culture as an institution as, say, Goka? How do you manage that balance?
That's a huge question. And of course, the problem of any relevant arts institution, I think, is that we are obligated. The nature of what we do requires that we're looking at planning exhibitions, you know, 2 to 5 years down the road. So, you know, trying to foresee what audiences are going to want in 2 years or 5 years or next week, you know, is something that is clearly an ongoing challenge. And so that's something we're continuing to struggle with, and not just the Fine Arts Center, but arts institutions in general. Because you're right, we are typically unable to respond on a dime. However, even if it's not a major exhibition, I believe that there are things that the FAC or that other institutions can do to respond to their community, to let the community know that we are aware of what's going on and that we are a place where people can come together and they can engage in dialogue and they can communicate and express themselves. And ultimately, that's what the best art is about. Even if the exhibition that we don't have on the walls happens to be related to whatever current events are going on right now, if it's a really great show, then people will be able to come and discuss. And I would love for the museum to generally be viewed as a place for that, as a place for conversation, as a place for the community to come together and have shared experiences, which I think is so important in looking at the future solidarity of our community here in Colorado Springs, nationally, internationally, is finding common ground. And I think through the arts, it's a great place to start, is for people to have shared experiences.
All right, Blake, looking back, exhibitions that to you were the most meaningful, and maybe give me at least one out of the historical bin. What are some of the touchstones?
Well, I talk a lot about that maintenance of balance over a period of time. And some of the things I think about that we've done that have just been tremendously memorable, and really I hope provide some indication of, you know, where we are going forward, are things like the James Turrell and Scott Johnson exhibition. So you had this, probably one of the top three internationally renowned contemporary artists side by side with a regionally based contemporary artist doing amazing and immersive work that's just absolutely mind-blowing. And that was an experience that unfolded as you went through. And so you were encouraged to spend what I call deep time there, where you get lost in the experience. And, you know, I think of things like, you know, we mentioned these shows that we have not only fond memories of, but really continue to think of going forward, like the Floyd Tunson show. I always come back to the exhibition we did with Terry Maker, a Denver area-based artist, as one of the things that stood out to me. I mean, hey, you get a 100-foot-long snake in the galleries, and what more could you want, really? And then things like going, dipping back into history a little bit with our own regional history, somebody like the Birger Sanzane show was just jaw-droppingly gorgeous and really sang next to an exhibition that Joy did with an internationally based Swiss artist, I believe, Katja Lohr, which was video, cutting-edge video-based work that was also just amazingly beautiful. And the way that those two shows, traditional landscape painting, essentially, and cutting-edge video work, that's really what it's all about. And there are a lot of people who bring that up again and again. I think of other, you know, the Sanzane was part of our FAC Legacy series, artists who have lived and or worked temporarily in this area and have helped define this region and our arts and culture here historically. You know, I think of our Charles Bonnell show from a couple of years ago, one of those artists who began with the Broadmoor Art Academy in the Fine Arts Center's earliest years and started with very traditional work and then followed all of the, or most of the modernist styles that were arising through the early 20th century, ultimately ending with abstraction. And that's a series that will continue this next year, in fact, with Frank Machaut. If you're familiar with the Wild Horses mural in the Fine Arts Center's courtyard, that's Frank Machaut. So we'll be doing a show of his work coming up. And I think of exhibitions like the William Kentridge show, you know, the first dedicated exhibition of this internationally renowned contemporary artist in Colorado. It was an original exhibition. It wasn't a package show, one of these things that we borrow. So that's the kind of thing that helps distinguish the Fine Arts Center here, as well as nationally and internationally. When we can bring that work in, conceive that show from the ground up, and really get it out to the world in a new way that's our very own.
Joy, I guess I would ask from you a peek at the future. What are you looking at down the line as you step into the curator role? What's exciting to you that's going on locally as well that maybe hasn't reached the halls of the Fine Arts Center yet?
I think all the shows that Blake just mentioned from our recent history are a perfect example and encapsulation of what you should expect to see in any given calendar year going forward at the FAC. I would like to see us continue with that outstanding balance that Blake has done such an exceptional job of finding that perfect combination of historically, regionally relevant artists, of internationally significant artists, of artists who are living and working right here in Colorado Springs. I am very proud of the fact that the Fine Arts Center, in any 12-month period, you can walk in and see one of those things, probably all of those things at the same time, if you're looking at our permanent collection galleries as well. So going forward, I certainly anticipate more of that balance. We have a fantastic program coming up this summer where you'll experience some beautiful new work by a local artist named Sarah Howsam. And seeing that combined with John Singer Sargent, combined with the third artist of Cindy Sherman, who is probably one of the most important artists living and working today. So I'm particularly excited about our summer programming coming up. Going forward, I would like to see more opportunities to engage with artists working directly in the galleries, to activate those beautiful spaces that we see on the second floor. I don't know if an artist-in-residence type program would ever be possible at the FAC, but I think that visitors really respond to work that has been made specifically for our space, specifically with our institution and our region in mind. So I'd like to see more and more of that going forward.
Blake Milt here, wishing you the best as you head off to the UK.
Thank you.
And Joy Armstrong, welcome, and looking forward to seeing what you do over at the Fine Arts Center in the next years.
Thank you, Noel.
That was KRCC's Noel Black speaking with the Fine Arts Center's outgoing chief curator, Blake Milt here, and his successor, curator Joy Armstrong. To hear that interview again, go to krcc.org. This is The Big Something from KRCC. We'll be right back. From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. Writer, editor, and UCCS adjunct professor Jonathan Marcantoni is committed to helping a new generation of writers find their footing in the rapidly changing world of publishing. I sat down to speak with Marcantoni about his recent novel, The Kings of Seventh Avenue, and his mentorship program for developing writers, called the University Project, as in Y-O-U. Jonathan Marcantoni, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about your background and where you grew up and how you decided to become a writer when you started writing?
Sure. When I was six, I started taking acting classes and doing community theater. And my love of writing came out of that. I mean, the very first thing I ever wrote was a play. And my love of theater carried over into my teen and early 20 years, and then I found I couldn't actually make money off of it. So when I was 19, I ended up selling some short scripts to a production company in Atlanta, and I also started getting gigs as a freelance editor, and so I turned my attention entirely to literature. But I always had a love of literature. I always had a love of books, especially African-American writers like Toni Morrison, Langston Hughes, James Baldwin. In my 20s, though, I started really getting more and more into my own heritage, which is Puerto Rican. I'm from Puerto Rico. Grew up and down the East Coast, however. And so my books since then have all focused on the Puerto Rican community, both in the States and on the island.
I imagine you've also explored Puerto Rican literature as well. And could you talk a little bit about kind of what characterizes Puerto Rican literature to you and some of the things about that tradition that you find interesting?
First and foremost, Puerto Rican literature is musical above all else. The most famous book from Puerto Rico is a book called La Guaracha de Macho Camacho, which in English would be roughly Macho Camacho's Beach. Anybody who's a boxing fan of the 70s and 80s knows Macho Camacho. He was a heavyweight boxer. And the book is actually written as a radio play. The author came from radio. And it's very windy, very labyrinthine kind of language that repeats itself, that very long run-on sentences that go on for two or three pages. And so it's very loose. And the effect of it when you're reading it is it's immersive, as well as there's sort of a sense that you could dance to it. Not all Puerto Rican literature is that way necessarily, where the musicality is so overt. But we have a great love of wordplay. I mean, from our poets like Julia de Burgos and Luis Llorens Torres, as well as writers like Pedro Juan Soto or Manuel Melendez, who he's a New York author and a good friend of mine. But that musicality is very central, and that's something that I've taken into my own work as well.
And talk a little bit about your own work and about how you approach writing. And I've noticed in your work you experiment a bit with form and with structure. And you know, it's interesting you bring up the radio play. It seems in your writing you like to kind of almost in some places write as if you're writing a script. It's got a kind of, you can clearly tell that you're informed in some way by that script writing practice. So could you talk a little bit about how you approach writing literature?
Well, one thing that one of the reasons I connect so much to La Guaracha de Macho Camacho, the author there, he said something very very personal to me, which was he said that in Puerto Rico, movies and television and radio, those are our books, because there's, especially a few decades ago, there was very high illiteracy. And even now there's very high illiteracy outside of the cities. So growing up, I was always very much influenced by movies, and especially movies from the 60s and 70s with that use a lot of chiaroscuro kind of cinematography and naturalistic cinematography and things like that. So in my own writing, I try to capture that cinematic sense of things. And I call my writing visualist, because I want to create visuals that pull the reader in and be very visceral with my language. One of the ways that I try to capture that visceral language is by having monologues, the characters directly address the reader, have scenes that are almost entirely without dialogue, where I'm just describing it, but I'm not trying to do it in a way that sounds like stage directions. I'm trying to do it in a way that is immersive.
So talk a little bit about your most recent book, The Kings of Seventh Avenue. Tell us a little bit about that story and about where that idea came from.
Sure. The Kings of Seventh Avenue is based on my time in Tampa. I went to the University of Tampa. I studied Spanish literature, and Tampa has a vibrant club scene. And in many ways, it rivals what's in Miami, but it has a very different sense about it because most of it is placed in a neighborhood called Ybor City, which was built by Cuban, Spanish, and Italian immigrants. It's very similar to Old Colorado City here. Just imagine that Old Colorado City was nothing but bars and clubs, and that's Ybor City. And I spent probably too many Friday and Saturdays bouncing around the clubs. And one of the things that I noticed and was very lasting for me was the very misogynistic aspect of club culture. And that came out most overtly during the Gasparilla Night Parade, which Gasparilla is Tampa's Mardi Gras, a month-long celebration. Lots of parades and concerts and things like that. And during the night parade, one of the most famous things about it is, you know, it's these people on these pirate floats coming in, and they toss beads at women if they, you know, show their breasts. And the first time that I saw it and I was around it, I was actually with my then fiance and now my wife, and it was really disturbing, like being there and seeing the look on her face of just like the way women are treated. And I have three daughters. So by the time that I came around to writing Kings of Seventh Avenue, I was very concerned with the kind of culture that they're coming up in. The fact that if they want to go to college, there's a strong likelihood that they might be sexually assaulted. And so the book is both an ode and a critique of Tampa and of the club scene. And I wanted to use the clubs as a place of refuge for the characters when they're inside of them. You know, it's this fun, it's very overwhelming and exhilarating atmosphere. But then when they get out into the streets, especially for the female characters, there's a great deal of paranoia and fear of, like, you know, what might come my way.
How do you balance when you say, you know, you wanted to go in and maybe even kind of critique a culture or critique a certain set of values, but wanting to do it in the context of a story and wanting to do it in a book that is going to keep someone's attention and that people are going to want to read for the storyline and for the characters? Mm-hmm. How do you balance trying to kind of do both things at once?
Well, the power of literature and why I go to literature more than not to tell my stories is the world that an author creates, it's going to be slightly different for every person. Everybody gets to make that world personal to them. Even if I'm very descriptive in the surroundings, different readers are going to take that in a different way. And what that does is, you know, I can write about a very distinct culture like the club culture in Tampa, Florida. And even if you've never been to Tampa, or you've never been to the East Coast or anything like that, you can, because you're personalizing the imagery and you're personalizing the characters to relate to you, it can transport into whatever your experiences are in life and make it real to you. So even though this book is very specific in its critiques to what goes on in Florida, a lot of these attitudes, a lot of the one-liners of the characters, a lot of the personalities of them are things that you'll find here in Colorado, the things that you'll find in New York, in California, even in other parts of the world. And literature, I feel, because it doesn't have that concreteness of, say, a film where, you know, you have the image is what it is, that you're able to make it more your own and really make it resonate in your life.
So in doing some reading about you, it seems that you've also been involved in the publishing industry as a publisher, as an editor. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your background there. I know you co-founded a press, I Know Press. And so could you just talk a little bit about the business side of publishing and how you got into that?
Yeah, in 2009, I started working as an editor for a publishing house called Savant Books, which is in Honolulu. I was working remotely, though. I've never been to Hawaii, unfortunately. but I ended up, first I was his editor, and then later on he became editor-in-chief of I Know Publishing, a gentleman named Zachary Oliver. And Zach decided to leave Savant in 2012. And he asked me to help him establish a publishing house called I Know Publishing. And so I was brought on as editor-in-chief. And the main focus that I gave to the editorial department was to bring in Latino talent, whether they were the editors or the cover designers or the writers. I wanted to give them that opportunity. And after being with I Know for 3 years, this last summer, I decided to leave it to focus on other ventures, specifically the university project.
And that's university spelled Y-O-U, university. Could you tell me a little bit about that project?
It's an online mentorship program that actually I started with one of my writers, Chris Campagnoni. We started this mentorship program to take our experience in the publishing world on the business side of things, as well as the creative end, being that we're both novelists, and then my experience as editor-in-chief, to educate up-and-coming writers on the multifaceted aspects of the publishing industry. Because nowadays, it's not just putting a book out there. It's using social media and the internet to get your work out to a wider audience. And it's also about interacting with your own community. So we not only teach them how to build a brand and how to network, but we also teach them how to do events, how to have a presence that's local, and also how to refine their own work. It is one of my philosophies when it comes to editing is that you should never tell a writer how to write, ever. The way the person's style is very personal, and there's too much of an effort, especially in writing programs or conferences and things like that, to try to smooth out a person's style so that it's more marketable or it'll appeal to an agent or things like that. And what Chris and I are trying to do is instead encourage people to make their style and their way of telling stories a part of their brand and attract readers to that, because readers nowadays, they don't want the same old, same old. They don't want vanilla. And there's so many people writing. You need to stand out.
And so this is, in some ways, kind of counterpoint to MFA programs that people might otherwise embark upon. And so you see it as partly mm-hmm. your goal to kind of push back against the homogenization of
right.
style.
Right. We consider ourselves the anti-MFA program. That's what we call ourselves.
And so did you do an MFA program yourself?
No. although ironically, next month I'm actually going back to my alma mater and speaking with their MFA program. So we'll see how it goes. No, I have a master's in humanities, actually.
And so do you see your goal of pushing back against the homogenization that you see in MFA programs and your goal of bringing more Latino writers and maybe other writers of color into the industry, do you see those as being connected in some way?
They are. One of the things with this homogenized publishing world that you do have is it is very much geared toward white writers, without a doubt, particularly white male writers. And when there are minority writers that are able to get into the mainstream kind of publishers, they're expected to only write certain kinds of stories. So if you're a Black author, you're expected either to do stories about slavery or Jim Crow, or, you know, something where the diversity of racism has to be central to it. You're a Latino writer, immigration, or, you know, pursuing the American dream, but it's always going into that bent. So even though you have quote unquote diversity, that diversity is highly limited. So what we're trying to do is, when we bring in minority writers, and I should just say, the University Project has been around for 2 years, and all of our students who have completed it have been females, which I think is very important. And not only that, but they're females of different ethnicities. And one of the things that we encourage with them is, you know, right now, actually, my current mentee is Nami Thompson. She's out in Boulder, and she's Indian American. And I always tell her, you know, bring in your South Asian culture, bring in that part of yourself, but don't let it limit the kinds of stories that you want to tell. You know, so she's writing a book about a mortician who is trying to connect with his daughter, and there's nothing South Asian about it, which is fine.
I think one of the other things that's really interesting about this university project is the way that it seems to be treating the career of writing as a career. You know, it's to use another analogy, it's like the mentorship thing you can think of as almost an apprenticeship in some way, in the way that you might apprentice with a blacksmith or something. Right. You know, the idea that writing this career is a craft, but it's also, it takes a lot of work and a lot of expertise in terms of knowing how to connect to this larger world in order to make a go of it financially.
Right. And it also requires a lot of poverty, to just be honest. There is one attitude that I'm definitely trying to combat against is the attitude that you should only try to create art or do anything. I mean, have any kind of career just to get fame or just to get money. That's not the ultimate goal. And I'm saying this as a poor person myself. So I am living my own example. But that should not dissuade you from expressing yourself. Art is ultimately about expression. And if you put limits on it, if you say that, well, because you come from such and such background, you can only tell these kind of stories and you can only tell them in a certain kind of way, then you're restricting, you're strangling that expression. And I think if we take out the connection, because far too often writing and the business marketing side of it are put together as if they're the same thing. And no, they're separate. When you're writing your story, you're telling your story. You figure out how to market it after it's done.
But you mentioned that part of the mentorship consists of learning how to kind of market yourself and learning how to connect with people through social media.
Because it's important to know it.
Right.
I mean, you definitely have to know it, but there also has to be that divide. And that is something that we teach them.
For you, when you're picking people for this program, how do you know when you've found somebody who has promise, who has potential as a writer? What are you looking for?
What we're looking for are two big things. One is a distinctness. I mean, they have to have strong writing. And they have to stand out with the kinds of stories they're telling and how they're telling them. The other thing is they have to have knowledge of who they are as writers. And the reason for that is if you're still at that place where you're trying to find yourself as a writer, we can't help you build a brand, because when we're working with these students, they set up their site during the mentorship. They are putting themselves out there. And, you know, especially when we do the networking aspect, if you don't have an idea of yourself and what you want to be, then it's very hard to make those networking connections. So it's not a program for absolute beginners. This is a program for people who are ready to take that next step.
Jonathan Marcantoni, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Jonathan Mark Antoni, author of the novel The Kings of Seventh Avenue, and a partner in the University Project, a program for mentoring up-and-coming writers. To hear that interview again and for more information on the project, head to krcc.org. This is The Big Something from KRCC. We'll be right back. From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. Earlier this month, authors Helen Thorpe and Jeff Hobbs came to Colorado College to discuss their writings on urban poverty and inequality. Thorpe is the author of multiple books, including Soldier Girls and Just Like Us. Jeff Hobbs is the author of The Tourists, a novel, and more recently, the New York Times bestseller, The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. In advance of their talk, Thorpe interviewed Hobbs for KRCC about this book, which explores issues of race, class, and social inequality through the life and untimely death of Hobbs' good friend and college roommate.
Jeff, you have written a book that's been a New York Times bestseller, an incredible book. It's called The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. Can you tell us briefly, who is Robert Peace, and how did you come across this story?
Oh, thank you so much, Helen. I'm so glad to be talking to you. Rob was my randomly paired freshman year roommate at Yale in 1998. Ended up living together all 4 years, and he became my best friend. 9 years after we graduated, I was brushing my teeth and got a Facebook message. I learned that he had died violently in a basement in a drug-related homicide, and in the months that followed after the funeral, just a community formed of people who didn't want to let him go, people who just were in touch, and we told stories, and the book came out of that.
So you and Rob had different types of experiences before arriving at Yale and rooming together. Can you sketch briefly kind of your background and his?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in the country. My dad was a doctor. All my needs were met. Rob grew up the hard way in Newark, New Jersey. His mother worked very long hours for very little money, mostly in hospital and nursing home kitchens. And his father was in prison, arrested, later convicted for a double murder when Rob was 7 years old. That didn't stop his father from using prison payphones to call home and go over Rob's homework. Our first laugh came out of the fact that he was a black guy from the hood who played water polo, while I was a white guy from the country who ran sprints for the track team.
I love that you're mentioning Rob's mother, who I think is an incredible character in this book, an incredible person. And I think that her struggle to create a different kind of life for Rob is one that the reader really empathizes with. But there's this moment that you describe where you meet her on when she's on the Yale campus, maybe feeling out of her element, and she's very closed and very guarded with you at first. And I'm just wondering, how did you get to know her so much better to the point where you could actually write this book? What was that like?
Yeah, well, when Jackie dropped off Rob at college, you know, first day of freshman year, she was reticent, to say the least. My mom was measuring windows so she could make curtains on her sewing machine, and very chatty. I mean, I met his mom a few more times through college, but we never really talked much. Maybe 6 months after Rob died and the idea formed to try to tell the story of his life and not his death in some way. I mean, at the time, I was just thinking maybe a small piece in the Yale alumni magazine or something. But, I went to her home and expecting to meet a shattered woman about 6 months after Rob died, nervous for a lot of reasons, but mainly just that talking about it, it would cause her more pain, which I'm sure it did. But in the meantime, she was so gracious and smiled a lot, laughed a little bit. And I think she was just moved that people still cared. And over the next, what turned into 3 years, talking many times a week, I learned that she was not reticent at all. She has an awful lot of spirit, and she's the closest thing to a perfect person in this story.
Yeah, we are, readers, I believe, are incredibly moved by her grace and her sacrifices. You have previously written fiction, and this is your first effort in nonfiction. And some of the subjects that you're talking about, you know, are generally written about in nonfiction, but you borrow tools from fiction to tell this story. Was that hard, and how did your drafts evolve over time?
Oh, sure. And as you say, I had no experience in journalism or research, and the research from this book was, for the most part, just sitting down with people and sharing stories, you know, friends, family, classmates, drug dealers. As far as the writing of it, as you know from your work, the best way to tell these stories is just to take your interviews, take your material, and sort of tell it straight.
Yeah, get out of the way.
Yeah, without getting fancy.
I know you've been traveling around the country visiting different college campuses, and it seems like race and class and privilege are subjects that are flaring up across college campuses all across the United States.
Particularly at Yale, where Rob and I went.
Yeah, what have you learned along the way visiting, and what have some of those visits to college campuses been like? And why are we having these conversations right now?
That's a huge question. In my experiences visiting, you know, Ivy League schools and juvenile halls and pretty much every space in between, it's been really powerful and also fascinating in a way. Students approach and respond to this book and probably your books as well, I'm sure, in different ways. I would say students from more affluent, sheltered communities and backgrounds, they wrestle with it. They want to make it make more sense. They want the lines to be clean, and it's a leap to acknowledge that life is messy, the lines aren't clean. Not everybody experiences each moment the same way, and decisions that seem totally irrational from the outside are usually completely irrational to the person making them. And when I visit inner city schools or juvenile halls, historically black universities, I would say usually met not with hostility, but definitely skepticism.
Because you're a white guy tackling these subjects?
Yeah, white guy, Yale graduate, wearing a tie. I think they're expecting me to stand up and say, don't do drugs and stay off the streets. And once we start talking, asking questions, they realize we're just there to talk about relationships, how people treat each other. Everybody has bad luck, makes bad decisions. In Rob's case, his bad decisions were life-ending, but everybody also loves their mother and their friends.
Yeah, and Jackie's love for her son, I think, is what stays with me when I think about this book as some of the most unforgettable moments in it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, thank you, Helen. I'm so grateful.
That was author Helen Thorpe speaking with fellow writer Jeff Hobbs about his book, The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. To hear that interview again, head to krcc.org. While the word dehumanization is likely familiar to most people as a concept, few may realize that it's also a cognitive function that helps our brains filter out painful information. But what if dehumanization keeps us from having empathy or feeling compassion? As Big Something intern Maddie Howard learned, storytelling can often be one of the most effective ways to open our hearts to those who are most vulnerable to dehumanization, the homeless. She brings us this story about a new publication designed to help people experiencing homelessness in Colorado Springs share their stories.
At 11 a.m. at the Marion House Soup Kitchen on West Bijou, dozens of people stand in line, milling about. Some talk to their friends, some keep to themselves. This is the start of lunch service, and for most people present, it's the first meal of the day. This year, according to the Pikes Peak United Way, there are an estimated 2,107 people experiencing homelessness in Colorado Springs. 243 are chronically homeless, 54 are veterans of war, and 922 are children. In the city of Colorado Springs, there's a deficit of some 400 beds for the homeless every night. But these are just numbers.
Well, I can't functionally say I never had a place to go, but I'm definitely one of the homeless who has to deal with mental illness. That's kind of what got me on there. I'm bipolar, and I ended up in a manic phase. When I get manic, I disappear on people.
This is Kira Fairchild. She spent 6 years on and off the streets of Colorado Springs.
I met everybody from people with like a sixth grade education to a master's, and the situation didn't work out right. They'd end up losing a job, couldn't find another one, and well, now I'm talking to them while we're eating something from the Marion House, you know? So there's really no homeless type at all, and the only reason we see it that way is because we never talk with anybody that's homeless.
So essentially, our volunteers talk to people.
This has been Criswell at the launch party for Grits Magazine. This past spring, he, Paige Clark, and Caitlin Canty, three Colorado College students, started the publication. It features interviews with and stories by people experiencing homelessness in Colorado Springs.
We go down to soup kitchens, down to Urban Peak, the youth homeless center in town, and record interviews, run writing and storytelling workshops, and generate material for both our website and our publication in print.
While efforts like this might seem secondary to other services offered to people experiencing homelessness and hunger, the value of this kind of work is supported by psychological research. In 2006, the journal Psychological Science featured a paper entitled Dehumanizing the Lowest of the Low, Neuroimaging Responses to Extreme Outgroups, co-authored by Drs. Lasana Harris and Susan T. Fisk, a professor of social psychology at Princeton. The study used neuroimaging, or fMRI, technology to test the ways in which different groups of people elicited emotion from others.
And so we thought that we would essentially just take people in the magnet and show them pictures of these different social groups, and we would see different parts of the brain associated with these different kinds of emotions becoming active.
This is Dr. Lasana Harris. When he and his fellow researchers showed people photographs of those who fell in the so-called lowest of the low category, homeless people and drug addicts, they saw something disturbing. The photos failed to activate the part of the brain that normally lights up upon seeing another person. It was as if they'd been shown a photo of an animal or an inanimate object.
When you encounter another human being, you automatically think about what they're thinking. You automatically get inside of their heads. This is something we do without intending to. It's something that doesn't take any effort. So what's remarkable is to consider a case when that doesn't happen.
And if you this neurological phenomenon, which Dr. Harris calls dehumanization, explains the familiar ease with which one can walk past the homeless people of downtown without so much as a backward glance. In terms of cognition, they may seem no more human than the pavement that they sit on. Dr. Harris's work suggests that this dehumanization is much more common than we might expect.
A lot of the work I have been doing in the last 10 years has sort of made this an everyday phenomenon. So we don't just dehumanize the homeless. We dehumanize lots of everyday people in our regular lives because this is a very flexible process.
However, the findings are not all so grim. This tendency to dehumanize can be reversed.
I mean, we did those studies 10 years ago. Since then, we've done lots of different varieties that have been able to turn it back on. So if I make you highly familiar with homeless people by taking you to a soup kitchen, you don't show this effect spontaneously because you're used to thinking in this context about homeless people as people, right? With likes and dislikes and personality and all of that stuff. If I tell you, oh, this homeless person you're about to meet is actually very interesting, you start imagining the things that are going on inside of their heads, you don't show this effect.
For the founders of Grits, publishing stories is a way to open the door to seeing the homeless as people.
I'm Tyrone Hunter, and I wrote an article for the Grits publication. I got involved because I like writing. I've always been writing. It's been therapeutic. And I saw a poster in the Marion House for Grits. They were asking for articles, so I submitted one. And next thing I know, they asked me if they could publish it. I was totally floored, and I still am, to see it published, my name in print. It's amazing.
Tyrone says adjusting to homelessness hasn't been easy.
This is all new to me, being homeless and being involved with, you know, eating meals and shelters and all that is brand new. I mean, I had a life, a big life before, and I lost it all, and I ended up here, and I had to take advantage of the situation and the services that were being provided, simple as that. So, and it gave me a perspective I never had before. It was very humbling, actually. It's funny to have people actually read something I wrote and enjoy it. It's been very, very pleasing for me.
The politics surrounding the issue of homelessness in the Springs are complex. It can be easy to forget that the statistics of homelessness in our city represent real people. Often, says Dr. Lasana Harris, objectifying the homeless can be a way of avoiding this uncomfortable truth.
If I expect to hear the homeless person say horrible things, I might just dehumanize that homeless person so I don't have to process the things they're saying. So that's one of the primary reasons, if not the primary reason for dehumanizing, right, is to sort of protect the self from feeling distress and feeling sort of negative emotions and having negative thoughts about the self.
Here's Grit's publisher, Ben Criswell, again.
The conversations are very humanizing on a pretty fundamental level, and you also realize how easily somebody can slip into homelessness or hunger. It's just like a million different variables that could have happened. I mean, you could slip on the ice, hurt your back. You could have a friend fail to like lend you money. Your spouse could divorce you or get cancer or something. There's just like so many different things that, you know, we all just, it's really just like a stroke of luck or a stroke of bad luck away for a lot of people.
After 6 years on the streets, Kira Fairchild knows what it means to be objectified or to have others presume to know her story. Her hope for Grits magazine is that the stories will challenge this mindset, to acknowledge the subjectivity of people experiencing homelessness.
Our brains love personal deals, personal stories. Anecdote is so much more powerful on an individual level than any amount of data ever is going to be. And that's just kind of how we're wired. So something like Grits that's giving out personal stories and letting you see in the lives of this particular person, that one story is going to do so much more than me sitting here telling you there really are different people on the streets. Like, I can say that all day long, but it's not going to make nearly as much of a difference as a single story, much less multiple stories.
Whether Grits makes an impact on the thousands of people experiencing homelessness here in Colorado Springs will be difficult to measure. But they hope to be a part of the solution, one story at a time. To hear more stories like Tyrone's, poems, or visual art, go to gritsco.org or look for the next quarterly insert in the Colorado Springs Independent, due out in February of 2016. For KRCC and the Big Something, I'm Maddie Howard.
That feature was produced by Colorado College student Maddie Howard, an intern for The Big Something. To hear that segment again and for a link to Grits magazine, go to krcc.org. This episode of The Big Something was produced by Noel Black and me, Jake Brownell, for KRCC. Special thanks to our production assistant, Amelia Whitmer, and our intern, Maddie Howard. You can listen again to this episode and learn more about today's guests at krcc.org.